Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, episode number 170. I'm Bob DeMarco, and today we are talking to Jason Knight, ABS Mastersmith. Jason Knight, someone I've been trying to speak to for a while. I'm so excited to have him on the show. He first came on my radar when he was a substitute judge on Forged in Fire, but ever since that, I started following him on Instagram, and his brand of kukri slash Bowie has just had me hooked ever since, and I love looking at his work. And incidentally, he also hosts weekends where you can come and learn his craft from him in his forge. And I'm honored to have him on the show tonight. Before we get there, if you value what we do here on the Knife Junkie Podcast, please go check out our Patreon page, and you can sign up at a number of different levels and support us here. It's greatly appreciated if you do. So without further delay, I would like to bring you Jason Knight.
Have a knife you want featured or reviewed? Call the Knife Junkies 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and let us know.
Jason Knight, how are you, sir?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Actually, okay, so that's a good icebreaker. You pulled a little shiv on me, which I've been seeing on your Instagram page. Let's jump right in. What is that little honey?
This is called the Voodoo, and I based this on a knife concept from the OSS during World War II. There was the Office of Strategic Services or Office of Special Services. But they basically told the French farmers to take one of their hay rake tines, cut it off, and wrap it with leather and kill a Nazi and get his gun or something, you know, the resistance.
That is beautiful. It's like a pocket gnunting.
Yeah.
That is
it is, and it's sharpened on the inside like a gnunting would be sharpened too. But only reason we sharpen it on one side instead of both, and on the inside instead of the out, is they are made in Italy, and there's some kind of importation laws about sharpened things or exportation laws there about sharpened things. So I decided to have it on the inside because I've used a lot of knives that are like, you know, they're recurved or they're inside curved, and they work really good, like a claw or a beak, or, you know, it's something natural like you'd find outside. But I've been using this knife for a while. This is one of the prototypes. It's just super handy to poke something or, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mix a drink. Maybe you could access something inside a clamshell package well with that. Or perhaps you get into the center of a beehive and get some honey. But that is that's a beautiful little knife. I love that. That's way up my alley. And if I had that, I would put that between my Elvia, that's a sort of Pakal style knife, and my little double-edged Topps dagger. So cool. I love that. So Jason Knight, so like I mentioned before, you came onto my radar first from Forged in Fire, and we'll talk about that later, but I really, really fell in love with the style of knife you make. It's recurve heavy. It's clip point heavy. It's kukri inspired, and with these beautiful ergonomic handles that harken to me back to a sort of Filipino thing. I don't think that's your influence necessarily, but tell me how you got involved in forging knives and how you got to where you are right now.
Oh, well, about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, when I was a little Latino, I just always loved knives, and I grew up in literally a primeval swamp. So people think, what does that mean? Well, that means that the swamp that I grew up in near Charleston, a little place called Harleyville, they never cut those trees. So the deeper we get in the swamp, the water is moving. It's beautiful. And there's these 1,500, 1,600 year old trees in there. And I was always bringing like a hatchet or a knife or maybe even a machete. Me and my cousin Andy and Brooke and David, they lived out there in it. They had a farm back there. And so I was always trying to like find the right tool, and none of it really worked. So I was fascinated with the concept of forging and trying to think how old I was when I saw Conan the Barbarian. It was, might have been 9. Really, my dad was like, "Oh, it's fine for kids. We'll take them." You know, so that movie ruined my whole life. Besides that, and Star Wars, but you know, they're forging a sword, and I mean, that's not how you forge a sword, but
yeah, they're actually pouring it into a mold. But whatever, it's great.
Whatever, it was great. I loved it. It gets a pass completely because it was so cool. But that was the thing that made me just go, "I got to figure out how you do this." And then the first bladesmith that I ever met was probably Daniel Winkler. But the first bladesmith I saw and was like writing articles about was Steve Schwarzer. He was working on some Woot steel with Al Pendre, and they would throw up a silk scarf and Steve cut it in half. You know, it was a magazine article. It was before the interweb and all that stuff. And then Daniel Winkler and Karen Shook. Karen Winkler, I met them when I was probably 15 or 16. I've been friends with them ever since. And then I began serious taking forging blades and making knives very seriously in 2001, although I'd been making them since the 80s, like 1986, 87, to be more precise.
Forging them from then?
Yeah, forging since 2001. I'd been doing just cutting them out and grinding them, whether it was a saw blade, I was cutting it out with a torch or just mild steel or hammering. I did hammer some copper knives, but I spent a lot of time in fields looking for arrowheads too. You know, that was one of my favorite things.
So I think we're maybe vaguely the same age, same generation. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, my childhood. And to me, you know, I talk a lot on this show about how when I was a kid, like your whole image of a man, like it included a Bowie knife on the belt or some kind of sheath knife, you know, if you wanted to approximate a man. And, you know, that still sticks to today. Not that I walk around with Bowie knives, but I always have a couple on me. You know, when I was reading your bio on your webpage, you talk about backyard adventures, costumes your mother made, and Edgar Rice Burroughs' books that your father read you. What was that? What was that whole imagination about? What was happening?
Oh, it's kind of funny because he would read me John Carter of Mars and Tarzan. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird because he is the Rice part of his family was part of my mom's side of the family, going back to be like the great, 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 great uncle, which is kind of weird. She discovered this a few years ago. And, but I just love the stories. You know, I love to hear them. I love the adventure. You know, it was like out of the frying pan, into the fire, mm-hmm. deeper, deeper, deeper trouble. And it's kind of weird in his era. He was the era of Steinbeck and Hemingway. He actually outsold them because he was a Pulp Fiction writer and he outwrote them and outsold them. It's kind of crazy, but I love the stories. I love the idea of the adventure of it always with nothing. It's just like, well, we prepared, but we lost everything. And it was total like a regular adventure would go, except for, you don't always win. And it's like one of the cool things in the story is like he always got his ass out of the bind some kind of way, you know, but I mean, how could he kill off the main character, right?
Right, right. Through his wits, and probably a knife had something to do with it. That's just me. I mean, my wife and I have this thing, like a running tally, where in movies, a folding knife or a small knife or just a knife saves the day. It happens all the time. And if you start making a tally. You were talking, so James Fenimore Cooper, you know, like all the, like The Last of the Mohicans and all of those old, illustrations from those books, they all had the Bowie knives. That always had a big impression on me. So, okay. So you decide to start making knives. At first, it's stock removal. You're cutting things out of saw blades or what have you and grinding them down. And then at some point, you decide to take the jump to forging. What led to that? You know, why did you want to do forging? And then how did you actually forge ahead with it?
So when I was in high school, I was going over, there was a knife maker, very famous, in Walterboro, South Carolina. And I'm not going to say his name because it doesn't really matter. People who are cool with you giving their information say, "Hey, this guy helped me out." Then I'm always cool to promote them, but I did it one time and he didn't like me referencing him. So I don't do it anymore. But he was a great, and he still is, a great blade maker, you know, knife maker. I mean, some of the most stunning hollow grinds you've ever seen. Crazy curves, big knives, recurves and stuff. And so I would go over there and watch him make knives and grind. And I'd cut out blades for him and drill the holes and stuff. And during that time, my dad was like he loved to play pool. So he won enough money in a pool game. I think it was 600, 700 bucks back in the 80s. He bought me a Bader grinder, like a BM2, which everything was on. You know, it was all rounded off then, so it was really tricky. And I would do hollow ground stock removal knives, or I'd try to anyway. But the guy was a very discouraging type of a teacher. So everything was like, oh, that's crap. Oh, that's crap. And it was just always garbage. And then in about 2006 or seven, there was a friend of mine. He was making some knives. And I would save my money and I would buy a knife from George Heron every year. And I kind of put it out of my mind to make knives. I just felt like, what's the point? But then I got back into doing grinding, and I was basically doing kind of a George Heron style, because George Heron, he was cool and he was encouraging. He was like, well, lad, and if everybody knew him, you know, they knew he'd say, well, lad. But he's like, you got to make this your own way. And this might not be your way. You know, you have to find another way to make it. This might not be the way that you're supposed to make knives. There's, you know, there's forging and there's other different ways. And I knew Daniel and Karen, and Daniel was a bladesmith and he was a mastersmith and he was pretty doggone famous. You know what I mean? And they were friends of mine. So Daniel forged and he had his way. And I was like, man, I'm going to do it. Steve Schwarzer forged, Don Fogg forged. So I was like, I'm going to learn how to do it. So I was working. I guess you could skip a little bit. I was working at a tire store. It's called Gerald's Tires and Brakes. One of the greatest jobs I ever had, but it was hard and it was a lot of work. And we would be changing tires one day. I think it was rainy and cold, and I was wearing shorts. That was our style. You know, we were all trying to out guy each other back in those days. A lot of macho. And, so my grandma was like, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to keep doing this? I was like, no, I really want to make knives. I want to learn how to forge. And so February 2001, my grandma basically was like, I will cover your butt until you can make this work. And I was just like, okay, I'm doing it. You know, and that's what I tell people now. I was like, don't try to make knives for a living. Just go make them and have fun. But like, if you've got something else to do, keep doing it and make knives, or do it because you love it, or do it because it's your art. But don't have your mind to go, I'm going to make knives and sell them and make a living. God. Well, I didn't want to go back and do that anymore. I only wanted to make knives. And so I went to the school. I met a guy named Jim Rodabaugh. Our teacher was Jay Hendrickson, and Jay's cool. You know, he's very famous for making that Bill Moran style and his style of it. And he basically just lit the fires for us and said, okay, go forge. I'm like, okay. So we were forging, and I would draw stuff and I would forge that shape. And Rodabaugh was making really smooth. And I was like, man, how are you making it so smooth? So I was just thinking about it like clay. So it was kind of easy for me. Mm-hmm. And then he showed me how to make them smooth, and we got to be friends. And I just went back home. I took, I don't know how many knives I forged, a lot. And I took about the first 10 I made, and I had a bunch of friends at church, and they were like, oh, I'll buy a knife, you know? So I was selling them for 150, 200 bucks, whatever I could get. And I went on, and I went to the Blade Show in Atlanta, met a lot of people, sold all my knives, went to Blade Show West, won an award, sold all my knives, and I just kept doing it. And I began to develop a style really early on because of kukris and Filipino knives and barongs. And okay. You're right about the Filipino knife thing. Because I had a style, I had a way I wanted to make these things, and I was just kind of, I was like, this ain't it. And then I started putting the curves in the handle. And I like, my dad had a 57 Chevy when I was a kid. And I like those fish hooks, those Maori style, you know, South Pacific Island, all that style. I like those curves. And I started putting them into the knife and making it usable and workable.
So this is pre-Mastersmith days though, right? You're talking
about. Oh,
right
yeah.
Now. Okay.
Yeah.
So now, so your style now is you're fully into the kukri. Are you making large? I'm putting words into your mouth. Are you fully into your kukri style? Are you making these large? You mentioned that you were starting to be influenced by the Filipino handles and that kind of thing. So, what is the style of knife you're making at this time when you're going to all these shows and you're selling out? What are people buying them for, and how are they being used?
So early on, I was making more of a couple of my focuses were because I was going for my journeyman, ultimately mastersmith rating, and there are parameters. Okay. So my goal was to make my style, but I had to do very clean finishes and very tight guard fits. And you know, so I slowly began to, you know, I'd make what I would call my Picasso knife. I'd be like, boom, there it is. And it'd be like, oh, everybody like, dang, that's so cool, you know? But then I would be like, okay, let me make this lame finish, you know, fit. It was a lot more finishing and fitting back then. And that was good. It's a good thing to learn, but it bores me. You know, it's very
boring. Yeah, but without that, you can't command the money, can you? I mean, without fit and finish, no one's going to buy your knives.
Well, if you don't learn it, no one's going to buy. You have to pay your dues. Simple. And I can do whatever I want to because I paid my dues. I've come up with my own style, my own design, and lent it generously to anyone who wanted to use it. I don't complain about it one bit. The Sobrals, you know, Claudio Sobral and his whole family, they were making Argentinian style knives and very cool, you know, and they were good, talented people. And he was like, hey, what about this one you made? What's this? I was like, just make anything that I do. You just do it. Okay. Okay. they got my knife on the cover of Blade magazine before I got my knife on the cover of Blade magazine. But I loved it because good for them, you know, good for them, and good for me. So it's perfect.
Here's my point with the fit and finish stuff. I'm sorry to belabor this, but you mentioned Picasso before, and before Picasso could make his cubist paintings and blow the world's mind, he had to prove to everyone that he could paint you, you know, in a photographic sense, in a you know, purely formal sense. Like proving that you have those fit and finish chops is almost your entree to be able to do what you want to do as a knife maker, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's like your own school that you're working in to master the basics so that you can do what you want. And I understood that because I am an art student. I did sculpture before I made knives, and that's something I guess I left out. But I would do carvings in wood and stone, and it just became an easy thing. Like, I could get a picture of you, your face, and your profile, and I could carve you in wood or stone. It was super easy. But I was translating the concepts because there was a lot of rules, you know, like when I was like, oh, they'd be like, oh, you got to do this and the guard's got to fit like this and it's got to be this. And I was like, okay. So I would do that. You know, I'd make them all like I was trying to make it perfect. And that's what I wanted. I wanted a perfect finish. I wanted a perfect fit. I wanted the design to flow and be perfect. And I made some knives that had plate guards, you know, they're standard. Maybe I call it the ABS style. I don't know what you call it, American Blacksmith style, but you know, cowboy kind of style Bowie knives.
Okay.
But nothing wrong with that, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to incorporate the things I learned from the stock removal knives, like the sculpted in guards and the, you know, just a little more flow and a little more function, getting rid of those big Ricasso areas. I always hated those. I always found like those are
like choil. How do you feel about choil?
Yeah.
You don't like a choil.
I don't. It's
has no place on your knives. That's for sure. Like,
you can do this and not get cut. If I do that, I'm going to get cut.
All right. Okay. So we're going to be all over the place. You keep holding up the MK Ultra. That's your folder. It's a collaboration design with Doug Markaida, produced by Fox Knives, and it's. I'm just coming out of No New Knives November, and this is one of the top five on my list, and it has been for a while. Tell me what it's like translating your very signature, robust, fixed blade kukri, and I throw Bowie in because I always see a little Bowie influence.
Yeah.
How did that style translate into a folding mechanical context?
Good question. So we made a, I was working with Doug and we had a lot of just sit around, just do nothing time. So I would draw and Doug's like, hey, I got this crazy idea. We could do this and we could make a, me and you could have like a collaboration where you make the knife, you design the knife, and then I would take it and use it. I'm like, okay. So we did first was a big kukri, which based on the Queen's Regiment kukri, which is a lot smaller than the kukri I normally make. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, we could do this and then train. The Gurkhas were being trained in some kind of weird Taekwondo style. And Doug's idea was that we would train them in a Kali martial arts style, which is more simple and direct. So I was like, okay, we'll make this little smaller kukri. So it was cool. So I made that. And he goes, oh, you know, it'd be cool if you made like a smaller, like a field size one. So I made that one, which originally was a half inch smaller than this. This is the improved version, which never went into production with me and Doug. This is the V2.
So right. That is fresh out. That's fresh out on the scene right now, right?
Yeah.
That
and then the folder was just based on that. And I'm not, and I had help with the mechanics on the inside. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this is what it will look like. I know that I'd made a paper up in a plastic version, so I knew it would fit in the handle. Mm-hmm. So I had someone work out the mechanics for me. So that is
so cool. I mean, I love that knife. That's about a 4-inch blade, right?
Yes. 4-inch blade.
Okay. And that blade shape, everything about that. And plus it's an opportunity to get a Jason Knight knife, you know, at an affordable price. I know it's a Fox made knife, but it's your design.
Yeah, they don't sell them. We buy them from them.
Okay,
so them to make them, and then they're through tacticalelements.com.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. So if I wanted to buy, well, which I do tomorrow, because tomorrow is December 1st as we're recording this. No New Knife November will be over, and I plan to buy a couple of tactical knives. So if I were to go to Tactical Elements, is that the only place you can find that knife?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Cool. So. Definitely check that out. Okay, yeah. So I'm bouncing around here, but I want to get back to some of your training. Okay, so in 2001, you end up going and studying at Bill Moran's School of Bladesmithing. Now, Bill Moran, to me, he's a classic. Well, he's one of those knife makers that's up there with Bob Loveless, and you know, he's got some signature styles that have echoed you know, through the generations after him. Tell me about your experience going there. And that was in Arkansas, the land of the Bowie knife. Like, what was that like going to Arkansas to learn how to forge at Bill Moran's studio?
It was a fun adventure. You know, I had an old Toyota pickup truck, and I remember I brought my bicycle. I didn't bring any. I didn't know what I was doing, so I didn't really have any tools to bring. I had a Sears Craftsman. The blacksmith's hammer, which was a crosspeen hammer. I brought that. And it's kind of funny because the first person I met was Jim Rodeball. And I was like, I'm not going to like this guy right off the kick. he was going around with the teacher, and I knew who Jay was. You know, Jay was a very famous bladesmith. And he was like, okay, Jay, whatever I can do to help you, da 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 da. And Jim had been forging blades under a guy named Al Barton for several years, who Al Barton was a master bladesmith from California. So he already knew how to make knives, and he was good at it. And I knew how to grind knives, but I didn't really understand really the dynamic of heat treating. So, like I said, Jay basically just like, okay, fellas, here's how you do a fire, and let me forge a Bowie knife, and that's it. Okay, go at it. And he let us go at it. I was like, how's this looking? He goes, yep, you're doing great. And we just kept smashing steel. You know, I think I made 40 knives at that time, but me and Rodeball hit it off good. And there was all these crazy characters in that class. There was one guy, we called him Whispering Pete. And there was a bunkhouse. I didn't stay in a bunkhouse because I, at the time, I was very sensitive to like the whole ghost thing. You know, like I walked in the old bunkhouse and I was like, nope. It's full of spirit. And I don't want to be here. Like, I just knew it. I'm like, I ain't staying here. And it was. And everybody else that stayed there experienced it. So
I'm laughing at you, but yeah. I'm laughing next to you. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just sensitive to it. So when I wrote about talking about one night, Whispering Pete was walking around, it was in the dark, and he was standing over his bed. He was like, "Hey, Jim, you think this knife is sharp enough?" And he's like, "I'm laying there sleeping, and a guy's standing over there over me with a knife." And I'm like, crazy stuff. But I had a great time, and I miss it. It was like, I want to go back and experience it again, but I'd have to figure out some kind of disguise because everybody knows me, of course, you know, but like, I could do something. I could come up with something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. No doubt. Grow that beard back.
Forehead. It gives it away all the time.
Yeah. I'm in that club. I'm getting my power alleys, as my brother calls them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. You're talking about frequently, I talk to people who work in different settings, not necessarily a forge. Okay. So a lot of people are really hung up on specs. How thinly something is ground to what dimension, and you know, some knife people can get very particular in their tastes, what they like. How does that jibe, like that level of like super particularness, which I'm not sure if that goes beyond just geekery or not. How does that jibe with forging, which seems to be a more elemental process? You know, you're in there like hammering out hot metal, and then you're taking it to the grinder and stuff. But, you know, it doesn't seem like so much. It seems less scientific, more emotional and instinctive.
Yeah, I think you're kind of right. It's very artsy. However, I am always in the process of making it more of, I don't like to use the word, you know, we've taken the word science and really screwed it up over the last 100 years, what we call science. You know, it's like, and the funny thing is, I was listening to a guy talk today. So his physics book from the time when he was a young fellow going to college is completely different than the one there is now. And everyone's like, "Oh, science never changes." Yes, it does. It always changes because you're not using the scientific principles or the scientific methods. So it's become, and I'm not trying to go off on a tangent, but it's just what I think about it. Bladesmithing and knife making is art. Specific knife design is more mechanical and technical. It is, you know, a certain knife is designed for a certain usage. Like, if I see someone's hunting knife or skinning knife, I can look at that knife and tell if they've ever skinned an animal before, or they just did a really good job copying someone else's version, or they listened to somebody like S.R. Johnson, who skinned a lot of knives, and they said, "Yeah, that's a great idea. I'll put that drop point concept into my lineup." I dropped a bomb there, but maybe it's just my opinion, right?
No. I'm getting hung up. I'm getting hung up for a second, and I'm thinking, you know, we're both art school nerds, and I feel us going down a rabbit hole, but like, I feel like, there is the design process, but there is also, like you're saying,
the history,
the history and the practical functioning of something.
Yeah.
That also goes into something. And so the, you know, the achieving the perfect, utility in that design is the ultimate design. And you said knife making is art. I would have to differ with you and say that I think that it's design. I think that art only has the purpose or the function of being appreciated for itself, whereas a knife can be used for all these other things.
Well, so, I agree with that too. What I mean more specifically is the process of doing it is an art. It's like a performing art in a lot of ways. And if it's not, I'm really trying to make it a performing art, because it is a stress reliever. It is a depression fighter. It is all these different things when you're forging a blade. Now, just to be on the, you know, go back to your other question. Technically, I make knives through many processes, and I always think it's interesting when I meet different people. So I make knives by forging. I make knives by grinding. I make knives with water jet and someone else grinding, or myself, or a burger grinder. I also make knives with 3-axis and 5-axis machines. So I've made knives and am making knives right now through every process available to me. And that's what's interesting, I find. Forging is just the part to get a Maybe it's to get a texture. Maybe it's to get a style. Maybe it's to get a certain thing I can't get by just reducing material. Primarily now it's to get patterning in steel or a forged texture, because all the steel that any of us are using as knife makers, if you're not making the steel yourself, you know, if you're making the steel, of course, you're going to have to forge it. But if you're not making steel, stainless steel, for example, comes in a big ingot and it goes to the rolling mill. And that process of bringing it down to the size is called forging. I didn't invent it. It's just the truth. That's the fun part.
So, okay, you say that you make knives across the entire spectrum of how one can make knives in this modern age, you know, from you forging to the most modern machine taking your design and executing it. Yeah. To me, it seems like the forging part is the most spiritual aspect. I have, I mention this a lot. I have merely dabbled as the most tourist of tourists in knife making in the 20 or so odd knives I've made over 4 years, you know, just in the time I have. And I know that it takes a lot just to take a little piece of steel and to grind it into something that I would pay money for. That's one dimension of spirituality, but you go to the level of heating up steel and looking at the color of it and going off of instinct on the color and your experience and knowing when to quench it and all that, knowing how to pound it out into a shape. To me, that seems like the most spiritual maybe aspect of knife making. How would you characterize it?
Yeah, I think it's a good way to process it. It's the most satisfying, if that makes sense. You're taking raw material or refined, you know, material that's not a knife, and you are forming it into shape. And we say beating and bamming. Hammering sounds so coarse, but it's actually, there's a lot of precision involved in hammering something into shape. Have you ever played with a piece of clay?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. So the steel moves exactly like the forming of the clay. Exactly. It moves the same way. No matter what you do, it will move in the same directions as the clay will move. Whether you use a hand hammer or a power hammer or a press or rolling mill, the clay and the steel act the same. In understanding that dynamic, you're jumping over a mountain and you're getting on the other side of this plateau going, whoa, now I can forge like easy. And I show that to people. It is like that. It is, it's deep inside. It's like cutting the river channel, you know, for the new river cutting its way across the plains. I don't know how else to explain it. It's like a new growth of something, a new birth of something. So that's the fun part about it. And it can still fail at any moment along the way. And then going, I know what I want to forge. I'm not just forming a, you know, a lot of times people just make a pancake or a spoon shape, you know. Mm-hmm. I try and throw people right when they come and take a class with me. I throw you right into the machine. Okay, just use the machine. Just do it. No big deal. And I can tell that they're uncomfortable, but I help them. You know, I help them and they're there forging. I'm pushing their hands along and they're doing it and it's so easy and they have fun with it and they're done and they're like, gosh, I made that. But it is a relationship forming, a confidence building. Yeah. Spiritual process. It's cool. It's a cool thing. It's fun to do.
And you talk about clay, and everyone who's been a child, and that's everybody, has experienced clay, and they know you add too much pressure towards the edge, it breaks up or whatever it is. That seems like a great analogy to pass along to people. Okay, so you do classes. You teach people your art. Tell me about that. How does that work?
People come from all over the world to my studio. I started calling it studio instead
of atelier, perhaps. Yeah.
And I've done a bunch of different kinds of classes, mosaic, Damascus, integral, chef's knife, all kind of crazy stuff. This year, 2021, I'm just going to do two with one exception. So I teach you how to forge a knife or a tomahawk. And I teach you every process of it. We'll design it. We'll forge it. grind it, heat treat it, every detail handles it. And you walk away, you're doing 90% of it. I'm doing 10%. It's always fun to see what people make, and especially when they go, well, you did most of it. And I'm like, no, that's your knife. That's my knife. Yeah. And they go, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Very different.
Yeah. Yours is way better.
That's mine and that's yours. So,
what's the difference between making a tomahawk? Well, I know it's a huge difference, but between making a tomahawk and a knife, is there a huge process difference?
Well, yeah, it's an integral tomahawk, so it's a lot more forging. Basically, take a 2-inch by 2-inch round and forge it into a T, and then stretch the handle out to make a full integral. And make one side's a spike, and one side's the blade, and so it's.
Handle goes all the way down, and wow!
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But what I found was, people could do it. It's like one of those classes I've taught, and it was like people, it's more forging. And so every class that we do that's more forging is always more fun and easier to translate. What's difficult to translate is grinding. Like, hey, I'm going to do a dagger making glass, and guess what? No one's going to be able to grind a dagger. So, you know, it's just, it's hard. It's really hard to understand that grinding. One weird thing I found, everyone who comes into class that can play a musical instrument. And I don't mean once a year for 20 years experience. I mean people who play all the time.
Yeah.
They grind easy. Grinding is nothing for them.
Feel. They have feel.
They have feel. So they can, I was like, can you play guitar? And I go, yeah. I was like, ah, you'll grind easy. And they do. Every time. I've never been wrong. They always just, shh, no big deal. They can play it. So it's always fun.
That is cool. So in terms of like the people who come to you, is it all bladesmiths who want to up their game, or is it people who are just have a hot nut to try out something new? Like what?
Yeah, it's 90% people who just want to go do it, and 10% maybe people who are making knives or want to make knives. Mm-hmm. Everybody, I try and present it in a way. That's why I call it a Maker's Forge Studio. I don't say class, school, and teach. Like, imagine how that sounds. I don't want to go to class and school and teach.
Yeah. Don't teach me anything, man.
But Maker's Forge. So you step into my studio, you're the maker. It's yours. This, you're become part of the process. And I involved everyone as deep as I'm in it. You're right there in it, getting dirty, enjoying it. You know, I take them out locally. I'm kind of a local ambassador. I like to think of it because I live in a real beautiful place in East Tennessee. So there's mountains everywhere. There's water everywhere. And I like to share the things that I like with them. You know, we have like this Asian fusion place called Stir Fry. If you've been here to my class, I've taken you to Stir Fry. You've been there. You know, it's a great place. The guy who owns it's usually in there. It's really cool. So I love that process. I love getting to know the people in the class. I love to form the relationships with them. I like to be, you know, you meet new friends. And then here's the other thing. I'm a rogue in a lot of ways. But one way I am is I will steal your knife concept in a second. Hey, a guy told me today, he's like, hey, have you ever thought about when you're mixing on that cardboard, the cardboard has wax? Have you ever had sometimes where it doesn't stick? And I was just like, oh, yeah. Yeah, never use cardboard to mix on. Don't ever do that again. But I was like, I appreciate what he said because I realized, man, he's right. You know, that's right. That's an issue. That can be an issue. But a curve, a line or something, sometimes people will drop them in a class. And I'm like, whoa, yes. Or they'll take something out. And I like that better almost, you know, taking something out. They're like, hey, have you ever thought about going from here to here instead of going like this? I'm like, ooh, I like going from here to here. That's cool.
Yeah. So, well, it's that concept of teaching. Like, you learn so much when you teach because your students come in it with a fresh or innocent eye, and they can give you things that you hadn't thought of in years or concepts that you don't, you know, that hadn't occurred to you. So what about you? What do you carry? What do you use knives for? And what, like when you're making a knife, what are you thinking of? And how are you, you know, where do you want it to go and do?
So this is one of my EDCs. That is...
Is that an integral?
Integral made by Tiger Lily. So that's one of hers. But this is kind of one of my favorite size knives because I can carry it every day. I usually will carry them like horizontal on a belt. So if I hop off the tractor or a motorcycle or something, or if I'm climbing up the hill, or it's kind of a mountain, it won't stab me. It's riding in a good spot. You know, it's very comfortable. It's very handy. I mean, we weren't born with claws and fangs. I am a bit of a savage, but I'm also civilized enough to use tools. So I always want to have a tool. I don't like opening stuff with my teeth. That's kind of stupid.
Or your keys. Yeah.
Tool. Yeah, so I like doing it, and I may as well do it in style with a nice knife. So I like that number one aspect. And so, again, growing up in that swamp, I like those big recurve choppers and Bowie knives and kukris. I'll tell you another thing where my knife making and Adam DeRozier's knife making kind of made a quantum. Adam DeRozier is a great friend of mine. He's a master bladesmith. His wife, Haley, is a master bladesmith. My daughter is currently up there with them in Alaska. But me and Adam, he was like a new knife maker. But he understood some concepts about the physics of the knife, like velocity and mass. Because we only had so much length of a blade that we want to carry, and it might need to be heavier for a certain size if we're going to chop with it. So Adam was making these really robust knives, and I'd played with it a little bit, but I realized like a really heavy 10, 11 inch chopper is going to chop better than a really thin, light 10, 11 inch chopper. It's just not going to be able to get into stuff because you can't generate the velocity. So that was another fun thing, thinking about it and then really inspecting old Quillian daggers, old Peshkabaz, all these old knives that were. Like if it's a stabby knife, if you look at the point, they're real pointy, but they're real reinforced.
Or right, if it's
a cutting knife, they're really, you know, they're either long and thin, or they're like in the case of like a barong is wide and thick and has taper in both directions. Just things that you don't pay attention to if you're focused on making the Bowie knife with the plate guard and the, you know, kind of the broomstick handle. I'm not picking on it. It's just. I don't believe the historical narrative of that knife, if that makes sense, because it has little to zero use. And I've used it. I was like, this knife does not work as good as this knife. Why did this become popular?
Wait. How does it have? You're talking about the coffin handle shaped Bowie knife, right? Like, and so you're saying that has little to zero use. Oh, please explain. Possibly.
So a lot of the old, my opinion, of course, all right, yeah. This ain't the law or nothing, but when you're looking at all these old English Bowie knives, they were building these knives based on a story about a land swindler named James Bowie and his brother Reason Bowie. And they didn't know what his knife looked like. Now his knife, I've seen, you know, some versions of his knife, and I think it's actually kind of clever if you think about it. That Bowie number one with that weird handle, it kind of lends itself to fencing and taking it and turning it over and making a stab, or like it's kind of like a wakizashi in the way it's bent in the middle. Yep. So it's kind of clever as far as a weapon goes. That's not the knife I'm talking about. The knives I'm talking about are all the English Bowie knives that were being sent over here by the maybe boatload.
Sheffield makers.
Yeah, the Sheffield makers. From the 1820s through the 1850s and 60s, a lot of these knife designs were just kind of like
they look kind of like kitchen knives, right? I mean, you know what they were? A lot of those Sheffield Bowie knives looked like gentlemen's weapons. You know what I mean? Like something that you would have in your cummerbund or whatever in your belt, and you would only extract it, you know, in a gentlemanly, you know, fight.
Like, oh yeah.
Yeah, but they don't. So what is that dag? Well, we'll get there in a second. But so to you, that was not going to take you all the way there. So you had to do what with your designs?
I wanted to understand the way the knife worked. And so when I was growing up, I had some friends. They had they were, my friend Robert brought these beautiful Filipino sisters over here, okay? And they had all these knives that they had collected. And it wasn't necessarily from where they were from, but they just, he had all these cool knives. They had like a bolo and barong, and they had all these cool things, and we would chop with them, and man, they worked good. And then I found a kukri and a toolbox when I was a kid, and there were K-bars in there too. And my cousin was like, oh, the K-bar, this is good. And I was like, oh, this thing is kind of cool. He's like, oh, it's ugly. That's a terrible knife. And I liked the kukri because it would cut really, like, it would just cut. Whereas where you're cutting with the K-bar, you were holding it and then ended up holding it with two fingers. That's right, not right. A bad knife. It's just not, you know, it's a knife intended to fulfill certain needs, and different, you know, kukris are intended to fill different needs. And I just was trying to take something based on my experience growing up in the woods, playing in the swamp, and say, what knife works the best for me clearing trails and bushwhacking and just going on adventures? You know, what works good? So I came up with a recurve Bowie knife with a big clip, and I added stuff to it, but I like that better.
Yeah.
And then when I was skinning deer and stuff, so this is a really old Adam DeRozier's knife, but this is a knife based on, he and I was making, kind of still are. We make a hunter that's like, you know, it's like this with a point. So you can, like, if you've ever field dressed an animal, you core their butt and field dress them. I mean, that's just the way it goes. But if you put a gut hook on it, guess what it's good for? Getting that pot off of your coffee off the campfire. That's all it's good for. It doesn't even make sense. But I don't criticize knife makers who design and use knives, or here's a crazier one. We think about the old mono a mono knife fight of the Bowie era, right?
Yes.
So I know some people, unfortunately, they have terrible, terrible jobs, and they've been in, I don't know if you want to call them
terrible
situations where, yeah, this is what they were using, and the other people weren't in a knife fight with them. The other people were probably sleeping. Just point in fact, it's like this is not intended for you to go, okay, let's have a knife fight.
This is intended
for me to save my buddies from all those bastards who are going to kill us, but I'm going to get them while they're sleeping. That's a terrible job, and I'm not trying to make
no. It's like Odysseus and Diomedes creeping across the battlefield in the Iliad.
That's right.
Not to get high-handed, but I love that scene, and that's exactly what that reminds me of.
That's what it is. It's terrible.
So hold that knife up for a second, and as you do, that is beautiful.
This is my version of the Fairbairn dagger, and I just made it more. It's the same length. And it's the same dimensions. It's a little wider, and it's twice as thick.
Yeah.
So they were like eighth of an inch. This is a quarter inch. And I worked on this when I was at Winkler Knives. And the idea was to put it in production. And I think they, you know, we had like 20 some of them, maybe 24, which they finished and sold. This is one of the prototypes. I've got one that's unmarked, and I've got one that's marked with my mark and Daniel's mark. So this is kind of cool. But this was in particular one that was with a bunch of different knives we submitted to a certain group because they wanted an insulated handle. So I came up with this insulated handle that was not rubber. So they wanted
handle? I was going to.
This one's micarta and G10 and G10 pins. So. Funny thing is no one had, I'm sure people have done it, but they wanted one that had, not rubber. So they found that no one had done it before, not this shape specifically, but the concept. And so that their attorney got it patented.
Oh,
that was kind of cool, but they have rights. There's another one. That's the one I call the Wilderness. Winkler still makes this one, but this also has the insulated hand. This one's also unmarked, but these were nice. We submitted all of them, and they were like, "Yeah, this is a great idea. We like it, and it, you know, it won't arc and it won't transmit electricity. I don't understand electricity, so I just know that I knew that all that material was non-conductive, so that's why I used it. But it was their benefit, and I like to make things for my friends. If they need a tool, I want to make a tool that they can use. So that's important to me.
So on a day that you get to yourself, what is a day like in your forge when you're not teaching a class and you have it to yourself? And what is the knife you would ideally be making?
Oh, I like making swords. But they're hard to make. They're hard to finish. But I like to make swords. I'm real fascinated with swords that are from that. I think it's kind of weird. We call this Egyptian, Persian, Greek, Roman kind of a
Bronze Age
stuff. Which strangely enough, I'm pretty convinced that bronze is a superior material to steel, but that's my opinion, man. It's just like my opinion, man. Well, it doesn't rust. It doesn't really decompose. It's can a you lot. Harden it? Oh yeah, you can make it hard enough to shave with. I mean, you can make. In fact, this is
actually my doorknob. Is my front door is bronze. Front doorknob. Yeah.
Playing with bronze in my forge, I was making a blade one time, and I had a 28-ton press, and some kind of way I just canted it in there wrong, and the bronze mashed the steel dies in half. As I closed it, the bronze pushed the steel. I had to make new dies.
Oh my
God. So it was just, think about what we make projectiles out of now. It's copper and lead or copper. Mm-hmm. So bronze is, that's a whole nother subject.
So why did they move on? Just bronze too heavy and?
Well, what if it was too expensive?
Huh?
What if they figured out easier ways to work steel? What if nobody living that you know or I know was there at that time to see what the hell actually happened?
Yeah. That's
all we really have are a multitude of assumptions. And one of the things that I never bought into was Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, because stone tools have superior cutting edges. They can push cells apart.
But they break easy. They're brittle.
But everybody can make them.
Come on, man. Join us in the 25th. Everyone can make them. Have you ever tried? Well, I'm sure you have. Flint napping?
Yeah.
That's no walk in the park.
Just drop something, break something. Go out in the woods and, you find flint or something. You make a bifacially fractured edge and it cuts. That's so it's just available.
Yeah. It's available and it is about the thinnest edge you can get, right?
Yeah. It's just it's a thought. It's not, like I said, I like to think about these, explore these. It makes me a better knife maker. And I don't necessarily buy the narratives that are just, here it is. Here's the box. Mm-hmm. Look in the box. Just look in the box. And okay, now look in this box. And I just never did it. I just couldn't do it. And I think it helps me as a bladesmith. Like even this knife, I understand the concept of this knife.
Yeah.
But I also understand that it's handier than just stabbing someone with.
Yes.
Very, very handy.
Yeah. The thing
stylus or pointing or poking something or getting a splinter out or. Super handy.
The things that make that an outstanding penetrator and stabber also make it an outstandingly handy implement all around. Something my grandma Tignarelli could have carried in her purse and been just fine with. All right, I got one last question for you, and now that on the heels of your last answer, I'm gonna slightly change it. And I usually ask someone of your experience what you would tell someone coming up advice wise, how they can, what they could do to, further themselves, push themselves a little bit further. But, I'm not asking you in terms of business wise, what's the best thing they can do or what I'm asking you psychologically. What can bladesmiths coming up, blade knife makers coming up, do to enhance their thinking and push themselves further in their art, design, craft?
I say focus more on the the why instead of the what and how. So focus on why you want to make that thing. Why does that work? Why is it better? Why is it important? Why, you know, all the why questions you can ask about, you know, a hunting knife. Why a gut hook? Why not a gut hook? Why not this? Why not that? You know, or why do it? And I think that will give them a more direct route to where they really want to go. Cause I watch people making stuff because they believe they should make it because someone else said do it, but it ain't what they want to make at all. Or especially on that business owner, absolutely, positively, do not make knives because you think I can make knives and make a couple extra bucks on the side. That's not possible. You can't do it. It's just, it's not going to happen. And I've been doing this for a long time. It's just, it's, this is not, this is a lifestyle. This is a way of living, a way of doing, a way of sharing your thoughts and experiences and feelings with the rest of the world. Just happens to be with knives. I'm sharing this with people with knives. It makes me a living because I figured out how to do it, but it is not necessarily make any kind of a business or any kind of, you know, capital venture. This is because I love it, because I want to share it, because I want to change people's minds. I want to see people become a maker of something or make a difference in someone's life or make a difference in their own life. So that's the most important part to me. And that's the advice that I really give people directly. Make a difference. Ask a lot of why questions. Go directly to the place you want to go. Don't take all these side roads. Take the arrow's path. You know, hope that makes sense.
That makes sense. There, you heard it. Jason Knight, thank you so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast. I really appreciate your time and coming on and talking to you. And I've admired your work from afar for so long, so it was nice to meet you in person, sir. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Do you carry multiple knives, then overthink which one to use when an actual cutting chore pops up? You're a knife junkie of the first order.
Well, it was great to finally meet Jason Knight in person, virtually. I've been, you know, a fan of his for a couple of years now. And man, you know, what a cool dude. I look forward to talking to him more. And I look forward to, getting that MK Ultra folder in hand, and then maybe for an anniversary, in the next year or two, going to his studio with my wife and learning the fine art and craft of knife making with Jason Knight. He says, ask the why questions. And to me, yes, for knife makers, ask the why questions, and for everyone else, ask the why questions in everything. And then, after a while, you have to silence them so you can act. But that, and then also the fact that I've never had anyone on this show say that perhaps bronze is superior to steel. And how cool to hear as a geek of the Bronze Age epics. And yeah, so that was cool to hear. Anyway, it was such a pleasure to have Jason Knight on the show. If you enjoyed this interview and you like what we do here, please check us out on Patreon. Perhaps if you have the extra scratch, you can help us keep these shows coming. So for Jim, working his magic behind the switcher, and Jason Knight, Master Blades with Smith, who was a pleasure to speak with, I am Bob, the Knife Junkie DeMarco, saying thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at ReviewThePodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, TheKnifeJunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at TheKnifeJunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on TheKnifeJunkie.com/Instagram, and join our Facebook group at TheKnifeJunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to Bob@TheKnifeJunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487, and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.